history repeats itself. When we examine it through a contemporary lens, new aspects of our social and cultural reality are revealed. I'm Suzanne Lang, and this is KRCB's A Novel Idea. A kaleidoscope is an optical device that juxtaposes elements and generates changing patterns according to the twist of the viewer. Alexandra Chasin's Assassin of Youth, A Kaleidoscopic History of Harry J. Anslinger's War on Drugs, does just that. It's a multispectral history that is unlike any I have read. It really goes deep and wide on where a lot of our opinions and policies on drugs and the people who use them and sell them came from. Later in the broadcast, we will explore the iconography of fascism and the transforming quality of objects with Robert Clara, whose book is The Devil's Mercedes, The Bizarre and Disturbing Adventures of Hitler's Limousine in America. So stay with us. It's a novel idea. Alexandra Chasin is a writer who is unbound by convention and form. Her exploration of history and culture is multidimensional, inclusive, and reveals connections that seem so obvious when brought together through her lively style and energetic research. Our aggressive war on drugs is not actually about drugs, says Chasin. Here is our conversation on Assassin of Youth, A Kaleidoscopic History of Harry J. Anslinger's War on Drugs. To say that your book blew my mind would be somewhat accurate. I found that, of course, I was warned, and you do warn the reader a little bit about what they're in for. But I found that the book was as much a comment on how we approach history, how we approach narrative, and in the telling of the story, that the form you used and the tendrils and avenues you explored, weaving that together was as much a part of the story of this book as the story in the book.
Well, I'm absolutely delighted to hear you say that, because that purpose was very dear to my heart. In a certain way, there's no new news at the level of content or information about Harry J. Anslinger in the book. What there is a new way of telling the story of Anslinger and of the ramping up of the war on drugs, and new juxtapositions, new arrangements for the content. That's why the metaphor of the kaleidoscope is relevant. But yes, it is, hopefully this book posits a way of telling history that admits that we historians, among other people, are subjective, can only know things partially, and rather than seeing that as a weakness in the telling of history, that we embrace that and understand that the writing of history is an act of imagination, necessarily, just as the creation of an alternative future is an act of imagination.
We're telling a story, you're telling a story about a time of history, about a person in history, but I couldn't help but reflect upon where we are right now, and not just with this issue of drugs and the changing landscape of that and the unchanging landscape of that, but politically in this country, we have, I think it's generous to call them an administration, but you know, we have a president and activities that are seemingly really happening. It is real life. But I think if we take the approach that you take in your book of looking at these pieces and these fabrications, and that people are skewed and people lie and people have self-interests and everybody's affected by history, that it maybe helps us understand where we are right now.
Well, I absolutely agree with you. It's an eerie moment, in part because of its resonances with the past, and certainly with respect to drug policy and drug law and general attitudes associated with that, what we think of, what we think is connected to the drug war, a whole set of assumptions and imagery that comes along with that. When I hear Jeff Sessions speak about it, when I hear Trump speak about it, I hear Harry Anslinger reanimated, and I already heard it during the campaign. And one of the things that I thought was super helpful during the campaign was this locution about the dog whistle. One of the reasons that I think it's important to look at the past, to look at the history of the drug war, is to understand some of the values that are coded into some of the language that we use to talk about the drug war. So, for example, the phrase inner cities, it's not just a neutral designation of a social space. It's a heavily loaded and coded term. And so I think when we hear our current so-called administration talking about the drug war, we are hearing a set of codes that come out of the middle of the 20th century and a set of associations between drugs and the threat of the contamination or disintegration of some imagined pure white American social fabric by foreigners coming across borders of non-white colors and bringing with them the undermining element, namely drugs, that is posing a risk to, as they say, that imagined intact American community.
And you start telling this story. Well, why don't we start with the title of the book, actually, and we can be here for hours talking about this, because it is a kaleidoscopic view of things. But Assassin of Youth, that is, and maybe we should set up who Harry J. Anslinger is for our readers and listeners.
Okay, so Harry J. Anslinger was the first commissioner of the Federal Bureau of Narcotics, which was established in 1930, and he held that position until 1962. So he was in that office for 32 years, and as such is really responsible for the establishment of the drug law and policy that we still have today that has produced the mass carceral system that we have now. So he was extremely influential, although he was never a household name or a big shiny figure like J. Edgar Hoover. He was more of the backroom bureaucratic type of person, very effective in his work, and as I say, very influential in the development of prohibitionist drug law and policy. So the book's title, Assassin of Youth, in my mind, applies to Anslinger, because I believe that the war on drugs has done tremendous damage to a number of communities and, of course, especially to young people, to African-American and Latino communities. Certainly, young men in those communities disproportionately targeted for arrest, conviction, etc. So by Assassin of Youth, I mean him, but by Assassin of Youth, Anslinger himself meant marijuana. So that was the name of an article that he published in 1937, and it was published in a nationally distributed magazine. So numbers of readers, kind of glossy type of magazine, very, very popular. And he opens it with a description of a white woman lying splattered on the sidewalk outside the apartment building in Chicago where it is imputed by Anslinger there's been a marijuana party upstairs and she's gone out the window and fallen to the ground. So she sort of serves the purpose of the figure of that intact white community I was imagining, I was talking about a little while ago, because she is of course, a figure that's been invoked for hundreds of years, the white woman whose purity is at risk. And again, the inner city, this is a scenario, apocryphal, I believe. I was never able to find any evidence for it, that locates the inner city as the place where this social drama unfolds.
And so you're quoting him to describe him.
Yes, exactly. And the thing about 1937 that's so key, this is the year that he managed to get the Marijuana Tax Act passed. When he came into office in 1930, marijuana was very little known, very little used in this country, and he first had to create it as a social problem, which he did by publicizing it, speaking about it, and particularly publishing stories about it in Hearst newspapers. He had a lot of venues, a lot of bully pulpits from which he spoke, and so effectively within 7 years had created it as a social problem whose solution was a federal tax act. When he came into office, there was a move to do a state-by-state kind of legislative approach to the matter. But in 7 years, he had turned the case. And as I say, this federal legislation went through the same year that he published this article, Assassin of Youth.
He essentially then takes this from obscurity, promotes it, kind of creates it as something that people would fear, but then maybe people would buy and people use. And so that it seems to me an irony there.
Yes, and I think that he was flagrantly self-contradictory on this very matter. He had a staunch critique of sensationalist journalism and reporting that might stoke the appetites of youth and other people vulnerable to drugs on the one hand. On the other hand, his own language, his own speeches and publications were pulpy and arguably sensationalist.
I got a kick out of reading some of his, training material for, there were, undercover agents that would go out there into the world and uncover maybe importation of drugs or marijuana. But some of the training material that you feature in the book is really kind of laughable, or I laughed when I was reading it.
I think it looks quaint to us now, partly because of our historical vantage point, but like watching an old movie.
Yes.
But it is also true that Anslinger had a real taste for covert operations. There he was in an enforcement agency in Washington, near to the FBI and the CIA as they came online. And he really liked that kind of operation, and it was, of course, an integral part of narcotics enforcement operations. There were constantly people going undercover, just as there were stoolies who were part of, you know, ratting out people. Wherever you have a set of transactions that takes place on a black market, you have a set of transactions that are unregulated, and there's no oversight for them. And so if all parties to the matter are illegal, then it's harder to catch and seems to require the undercover work, of which Anslinger was a really big fan. So I think he was partly just speaking for his times, where there was a lot of enthusiasm for undercover operations across agencies, and I also think that it spoke to his personality.
Yes, and he does instruct people to, yes, write on toilet paper. Take notes on toilet
Absolutely.
Paper.
I mean, there was also, I think, one of the reasons that I wanted the book to have this kaleidoscopic effect was that I wanted to look at the range of disciplines and genre and media within which the drug war has operated, because there are really a wide range of social practices and jargons and contexts in which the drug war is really active and operative. And in the 1950s, there was a whole rash of narc autobiographies and memoirs, and where you get a kind of a hard-boiled representation of tough guys who are sleuthing out, who are doing the undercover work, who are putting themselves at risk, who are entering into worlds we can't even imagine. And so one of the things this kaleidoscopic approach does is allow me to dig, to just kind of dip into a range of historical genres. And as I say, you know, Anslinger was a member of his times and was right in there with some of the kind of narc narratives, the popular narc narratives of the mid-century.
And in the book, you have a lot of archival material that serves as kind of a springboard for your own riffing and thinking about and expressing all this information. And how did you approach the organization of all this?
Yeah, so the book is based in some very standard historical research techniques. I went to the archive and I looked at Harry J. Anslinger's papers. I looked at what he collected. I looked at what he wrote, and I got a sense of what he had done in his career, and the book is organized fundamentally, chronologically. So those very standard conventional moves are anchors for a stylistic and disciplinary departure that the book wants to take. I felt that if I were going to make an argument that we should be telling history a little bit differently, and that if we should be admitting of acts of imagination as part of the work of doing history, and this is a challenge to a discipline that has operated, in the sphere of the humanities, but really wants to be able to ground itself in truth claims, that if I was going to mess with that approach to writing history, that I should really ground the material in some of these very conventional techniques. So there are 600 footnotes in this book, partly because I wanted to say, look, the standard historical moves have been made here. This is all based in archival research. What I'm saying took place essentially took place. But there's a reason to try to tell the story differently. So the organization is very standard in that way, to go to your question. And then the points of departure are, I think, on a stylistic level, but pervasive enough or central enough to the way the book is written to try to pose a challenge to the discipline of history. So, for example, there are characters in the book that are not exactly historical personages. And that's one technique that represents a kind of a departure from the normal way of telling history.
You just said there was a reason for that. Is that reason partly an acknowledgement really of who we are as people and how we think and respond in the world?
I'm not sure if this goes directly to your question, but I felt like the reason to try to experiment with, in a sense, undermine some of the conventions of the normal ways of telling history was it struck me that those ways of telling history have a lot to do with the kinds of logic and argument on which the drug war itself is founded in the first place. So I thought Anslinger was a guy who was particularly afflicted by what I call rectilinearity, by linear thinking, by literal straight lines, including the prison bars, but also he came up working in the Pennsylvania Railroad Company and timetables and graphs, actuarial tables, all kinds of x-axes and y-axes kind of ruled his world. And so I thought, if I'm going to write a critique of this person's career, I need not to reproduce the kind of thinking that underwrote his career. I have to write in a way that rejects the kind of logic that for him amounted to what we call later in the 20th century, three strikes and you're out.
Yes.
And so where he was, for example, in favor of mandatory minimum sentencing, from which we still suffer, I tried to write in a way that countered that. And so the sentences are maximal rather than minimal.
And you just told us how he came up through the railroads in Altoona, and that maybe helped form some of this rectilinearity. And you juxtapose him and that with Einstein, who also was musing on the clock at the train station across from where he worked, and the result being so different, and that Einstein's theory of relativity grew out of perhaps watching a clock.
Well, it is interesting, and I think not entirely coincidental that both Anslinger and Einstein worked out some of their theories around trains and train stations, very literally watching trains come and watching trains go. And yes, coming to very opposite ways of thinking about the order in the world and universe, though coming about both of them, coming of kind of intellectual age at a time when time itself was being coordinated globally, and the way the story goes, it was the train industry that brought about the global coordination of time. So all of that seems relevant in that this has to do with how they were organizing their own thoughts. I mean, even just at the level of logic, the chronologic of the late 19th century was very influential on both Anslinger and Einstein, on everybody alive at the time.
The railroads, and I found that pretty interesting. I don't know if that's something I actually knew before about that contributed to the standardization of how we tell time. Just because trains needed to be someplace and we needed to know when they were going to be there.
Absolutely. In the 1870s, the time in one, although you might have a train timetable that applied across localities, 7:09 in one locality wasn't necessarily the same time as 7:09 in a neighboring locality.
And I also found it interesting that in the development of the railroad system, foreign laborers, Chinese laborers, would come over to this country and do work, and that then you keep this spinning into a whole nother aspect in that kaleidoscopic view of drugs and how we culturally dealt with them, and really opium and derivatives were used. I mean, were given to women for menstrual cramps, and that over time, because of the influence or the appearance of these opium dens and coming from the Orient and drugs coming from the Orient, that our cultural perspective on these changed, and so maybe could you talk a little bit about that?
Yes, I mean, it's really uncanny how much repetition we're seeing right now of some of the dynamics that were in play on the West Coast in the late 19th century. So in San Francisco, you saw the first local ordinance ever against narcotics, which was against opium smoking. And that is because opium smoking tended to be the form of ingestion used by Chinese immigrants, whereas, as you point out, there were plenty of other ways of taking opium that tended to be medicinal or tended to be used by white people, for example, taking it in an alcohol solution called laudanum. So there you see a case where the same chemical, that is the opium, is differently socially meaningful depending on how it is used, because those differences correspond with social differences. And so that reminds you, I mean, that anticipates, I should say, the treatment, for example, of cocaine in the 1980s and early 90s, where powder cocaine and rock cocaine were treated extremely differently legally, even though chemically they're the same substance, and that difference is accounted for by the different social context in which they tended to be used and the different kinds of users for the different forms. So already you have that kind of logic at work in San Francisco in 1875, and part of what's at stake in the 1870s is, and earlier, already been true for some time on the West Coast, was that there was fear that Chinese workers were underselling the labor of white people. So that, again, is something that recurs now, where good white American jobs, the birthright of native-born white Americans, according to the discourse, is at risk by foreigners who will work more cheaply. And so you see how each drug gets a certain social or immigrant group associated with it very early on, that is in that 19th century moment, Chinese and opium. And you see how that's related to the idea of labor dynamics, and you see how it underwrites xenophobia as well as legislation behind the xenophobia, as well as treating different drugs differently, even though they're chemically similar because of the social differences that go with the different ways of using the different forms. All of that already in play in the 19th century.
I hope our listeners are getting a feel for the book, that you cover a lot of territory that kind of spirals through the book, and I found that very compelling, and again, it felt very in the moment to me, even though you're describing things that happened 100 years ago.
Well, as I say, I do think the resonances with the current moment are so important because, I thought this before the election in the fall, but I will say that since the election, I think it's even more urgent to have a sense of what historical trends we're drawing on and what we're going to be reproducing. All the troubles with drug prohibition were already knowable and known during alcohol prohibition. So one of the things that's so crazy about the drug war is that we have a national commitment to a policy and to a set of practices that fails decade in and decade out, whereas in 13 years we understood that alcohol prohibition was a complete and total disaster as well as impossible to pull off. We have every reason to know all the same things about drug prohibition and are still committed to it.
It seems to me that somewhere in the book you say that, well, we made a swap in order to keep alcohol, we had to give up dope or something to that effect.
Well, sure, because the timing of the end of alcohol prohibition ends in 1933. The Federal Bureau of Narcotics was established in 1930. So you have very concretely a transfer of some agents from one agency to the other. But I do believe on a moral level that as alcohol was rehabilitated, drugs did kind of move in to take the rap for a kind of social taint. And I think that the reason that drug prohibition has been so much more popular and stable, even though it is a complete failure, that is to say that the war on drugs does not actually significantly reduce, much less eliminate, drug traffic or drug use, is that it has unintended social benefits. So my particular political skew is such that I believe that the incarceration of young Latino and African American men in such disproportionate numbers, I believe that is essentially perceived as a social good that attends the war on drugs, even though reducing and eliminating drug trafficking use is not one of the effects of the war on drugs. So I believe that racism and xenophobia keep this policy in place.
Do you have any sense of hope or thought that this is something we as a society can find our way out of, this sort of institutional racism that is now fairly overt right now when you talk about Jeff Sessions and others?
I'm not especially optimistic. I think we come from a lot of long traditions that are working against us. I believe that the Puritanism and Victorianism that essentially helped put the alcohol prohibition in place in the first place are still with us, that they have very long-lasting effects, and that even though it looks like we're in a kind of cultural free fall and sex and drugs and rock and roll and commodity capitalism have, you know, taken over, I don't think that's completely true. I think we still have very, very puritanical and moralistic ideas underneath all of that. So I'm not particularly optimistic at this moment that we're working toward the kind of legalization that you see in other countries where there are really significantly different models. But I do think that there's a growing movement oriented toward harm reduction. There's certainly lots of social and political action around ending the war on drugs, and there's a lot of activism and commitment to that right now. So with slow and steady work, as with any social movement, that may yield over time. But as you say, we're in a very vexed moment right now. We need to take the long view.
Yes, yes. Well, Alexandra Chasen, Assassin of Youth, A Kaleidoscopic History of Harry J. Anslinger's War on Drugs. Well, thank you so much for this dynamic book, and thank you for joining us today.
Thanks so much, Suzanne. Great to talk to you.
My conversation with Alexandra Chasen. I'm Suzanne Lang, and this is KRCB's A Novel Idea. When we think of Adolf Hitler, we may have an image of him from Leni Riefenstahl's 1935 film, Triumph of the Will, standing up, saluting the masses, while being driven around in an enormous car. The Nazi cars were part of their messaging, but those cars were also automotively remarkable, and several found their way to this country, where they served, in some cases, an opposite purpose from that of their original owner. Journalist and historian Robert Clara has followed the life of a couple of these cars in The Devil's Mercedes, The Bizarre and Disturbing Adventures of Hitler's Limousine in America. Clara has worked as an editor and writer for several national magazines, and his work as a historian uncovers many facets of our history. Here is our conversation. Your book is The Devil's Mercedes, The Bizarre and Disturbing Adventures of Hitler's Limousine in America. This book, in my mind, follows a trend I'm seeing with authors who didn't live directly through World War II era, going through a reexamination of some of that through a contemporary gaze. And it's something that has interested me quite a bit and partly what drew me to your book.
Yeah, I share that sentiment. And speaking for myself, it's almost like there was a kind of shadow war or a war that we continue to try to interpret. It was just such a monumental event that in a way it makes sense that people are still puzzling their way through it. But because obviously I'm too young to have experienced the war or the immediate post-war period, you can do it through various means. And in this case, I did it through artifacts.
Yes. And in the book, you also allude to that maybe even people at the time may not have fully grasped during the war and in the immediate aftermath the true horror and brutality of the whole thing. And that was part of the fascination with these cars.
Yeah, that was a theme that I struggled mightily to explore and express, I hope, coherently, because I wasn't around in 1948, so I don't know. But from what I could gather, based on the reactions of people to these automobiles, I think that the immediate post-war period was defined, obviously, by a great deal of patriotism, by the flush of victory, which is certainly understandable. And it's why the cars drew enormous crowds of very patriotic, enthusiastic people who looked upon the limousines as war trophies, as tokens of battle and victory. And then as the years unfolded, a deeper and more complex understanding of the symbolism of the vehicles gradually emerged. And that was something that I worked very, very hard to explore.
And for our readers, the book does detail the lineage of some of the limousines, the Mercedes limousines. Hitler and his entourage were driven around in these vehicles.
Hitler could drive, but he did have a driver's license. But I guess it was part of his megalomania that mandated that he be driven around. And it was that way from the early days.
And these vehicles, which found their way into the United States, are so iconic. And in your discussing them, you often use language that is very strong, like the grill was like a knife edge, or just in describing them, that the persona of these vehicles actually seemed somewhat intimidating and demonic.
Yeah, and this is something that I've become a little self-conscious about, because it's very difficult knowing what you know, what we know, what I know now about these cars. It's very difficult to look at them and not read a certain amount of symbolism into what you're seeing. For me, that problem is complicated by the fact that I also have a master's degree in literature, so I spent many years exploring symbolism and writing papers about this kind of thing, and so it kind of informs how you look at the world. And I was criticized at one point or another for you know, seeing too much, for reading too much into the actual appearance of the cars, because after all, they were just Mercedes-Benz's, you know, of 1940, 1941. Cars had similar styling around that time to the 770K Mercedes that I'm writing about. That said, there is something that is definitely intimidating, over-large, and kind of mystifying about these cars, the way that they were designed, the way that they were styled, I argue in the book, was part of the Nazi stagecraft at the height of Hitler's power. They were part of the propagandist pageantry and imagination of the National Socialists, and they played a very functional role in elevating the status and to a great degree the fearsomeness of Hitler. And the thing that shook me was that all these decades later, in a sense, they're still doing that.
Yes, yes. And the cars also literally elevated Hitler. He would drive around in these, and there was a platform that he stood on, yes.
Yes, hidden beneath the front passenger seat. Hitler didn't like to ride in the back seat. He rode in the front. If you've seen Riefenstahl's famous footage, it's a, you know, a classic rendition. And he's standing in the front seat, holding onto a bracket behind the windshield frequently. And, of course, his right arm is aloft. And what people didn't realize is that Mercedes built a special platform that was hidden beneath the front seat. You could fold up the bottom cushion of the front seat, and there was a platform that was about 6 inches tall, and Hitler would stand on that. It would make him appear taller. He was a man of only modest height, so it did increase his stature, both symbolically and literally.
And these cars, which found their way to this country after the war, also people had an automotive interest in them, because they actually were, not just because of a platform, but they were like armored cars, but they also were turbocharged and had an incredible ride by all accounts.
Yes, as pieces of machinery, they were enormously impressive creations. They had value apart from their provenance, I suppose you could say, their Hitler provenance. The cars passed obviously increased their value, as with so many material relics. If they've had a famous owner, usually they sell for more money. If they've had a famous and notorious owner, for more money still. But in the case of the cars, it is possible to appreciate these limousines strictly as pieces of automotive engineering, although I didn't personally do that in the book, because I felt and feel very strongly that if an object has Hitler in its past, you can't really ever divorce Hitler from the picture. But insofar as the cars are still automobiles that are fully functional, yeah, they were incredibly impressive. They were 20 feet long. They were 10,000 pounds. They could fit 8 people. And I have spoken to a few people who have either driven them or ridden in them, and it was essentially like riding around in a house. From what I understand, I've been inside of one of them, but I haven't driven in one of them. I don't really think I need to. They are absolutely enormous, and when you have a car that's 5 tons, I guess having a smooth ride isn't difficult.
And it sounds like at least some of the models, I don't know if calling them four-wheel drive is correct, but it sounds like all the wheels had an independent suspension.
They were technologically advanced for the time. American cars hadn't quite gotten into that yet. And there's 2 cars at the center of my story. And when one of them arrived in Boston Harbor in the summer of 1945, the Army brought it back. And the GIs were fascinated by it. They kept pushing down on the fenders and watching the car rock back and forth like a baby carriage, because independent suspension was something of a novelty. This car, technologically speaking, represented the vanguard of automotive engineering. And Mercedes-Benz then and now is at the vanguard of automotive engineering. So this was, in many ways, the best car that you could get your hands on, certainly in Europe. I leave it to, you know, automobile aficionados to argue if Americans were, you know, building better or comparable cars. But as an automobile, it was about as nice as you could do.
It sounds from just one brief paragraph in your book that you had an early encounter with one of these limousines. And is that the genesis?
Yeah, I did. And it stayed with me all of these years because it's just the sort of thing that sticks with you. I grew up in a small town in upstate New York, and there wasn't a great deal to do up there. And every year at the end of the summer, we would go to one of the county fairs up there. I remember next to a home that had been hollowed out of a redwood tree, there was a trailer advertising Hitler's limousine in it, and my mother gave me 50 cents to go up in it. She didn't want to part with the money, not because it was 50 cents, but I think she didn't want to encourage an unhealthy interest in Hitler. But I went into the trailer. I do remember seeing a very long black limousine. It certainly had bulletproof glass. The car was fenced off, but you could put your hand through. And I remember feeling the thickness of that glass. It was, you know, it was 2 inches thick or so. It was incredibly, especially for a little boy, a very novel, impressive experience. I remember seeing this quite clearly, and it stayed with me all these years.
Well, there are some incredible stories in the book that you essentially trace the lineage of two automobiles and the kind of mythology around them and how they were brought to this country. And in tracing the paths of these two cars, you encounter some interesting stories, like the G.I. Joe Azara, who really was the one who was responsible for that initial car that then the U.S. military took over. So you want to tell us a little bit about him and that spar of the story?
Yeah, of course. Joe Azara was from Cleveland, Ohio. He was a technical sergeant with the 20th Armored Division. The 20th Armored came to the European theater late in the war. So they were doing mostly cleanup stuff, fighting the vestiges of the Wehrmacht, and they found themselves in Bavaria, in the vicinity of Berchtesgaden, which was Hitler's country retreat, in the spring of 1945. And Azara was on patrol one day in his jeep, and he noticed something in the distance that looked unusual, and as he got in closer, he could see it was an enormous limousine that was lashed to the back of a flatbed railroad car. And he fought off four German soldiers to get a look at the car. He didn't fight that to get another jeep or a military vehicle. He could tell that the curves of the car were civilian and that it was a very fancy car. So in a very real sense, he risked his life to capture this car. And once he took possession of it, the Army basically used it as a party car. From what I can tell, it was used to transport, you know, the American brass around in the days after the war. And then the U.S. Army held on to it and brought it back to the United States. They did so because the Treasury Department had put in a request for Hitler autos, if they could find any, and of course they found a few, or what they thought were a few, and they brought them back to the United States and put them on the road. They put them on a publicity tour to sell bonds to pay for World War II. And so Sergeant Joe Azara, who, so far as I can tell, secured the biggest souvenir of World War II and managed to get it home, drove up and down the East Coast in this car with his buddies, and they sold a lot of war bonds. And so it was one of the examples, too, of the cars kind of reversing its symbolic polarity, if you will, going from being a symbol of great evil to being a force for good, to, you know, helping to pay the American costs of fighting World War II. And that was very pleasing to the public. And it was an early sign that these cars had tremendous drawing power. And unfortunately, Sergeant Joe never got his car back. The Army promised to give it back to him, but they never did.
No, they didn't. They sold it at auction. Yes, yes.
At a surplus auction, as our government does.
And then there was another car that found its way to this country, and it was called Hitler's car, and it also was mm-hmm. repurposed for good, if you'll say.
In part, yes. That car that we're talking about is in the book I refer to as the Mannerheim Mercedes. I don't want to give too much away, but I'll say that it had been linked to Hitler. It does have a link to Hitler, but it was mainly in the possession of Field Marshal Mannerheim of Finland. And the car got here pretty much by accident. A Chicago businessman named Christopher Janus, in the days after the war, he was running an import-export business, and he had shipped a huge quantity of ball bearings to Sweden. And he expected to be paid in American dollars, but the Swedes didn't have American dollars. And so Janus was going to lose his shirt on the deal. And so he did what, you know, any good businessman would do. He said, "What do you have? I'll take something in trade." And the Swede on the phone is a gentleman I've never been able to identify. But he said, "Well, how about a car?" And Janus, it's funny, Janus had been waiting. He'd been on the waiting list for an American car because he was waiting for the assembly lines in Detroit to retool. But he was in the hole for $35,000. And, you know, that was so much more than any American car was selling for. So Janus told him, "No, I'm not going to accept a car in lieu of this amount of money." And the Swede said, "Well, it's not just any car. It was Hitler's." And that started the story of that car. Of course, Janus, probably against his better judgment and certainly against the better judgment of his business associates, decided to take the car in trade. And it arrived in the United States in New York aboard the liner Stockholm in 1948. It arrived at Pier 57, which is just a few blocks north of actually where I work today. And from the moment that car emerged from the hold of the ship, it started getting headlines, and it got them for years and years and years. So in the case of both of these cars, pretty much from the second their tires touched American soil, newspapers began covering them.
And Janus also did kind of use it, maybe not his exclusive family car, but he did drive it around.
He did, and he's a very complicated figure. I think he was essentially a benevolent man, and what I admire about him is from the get-go, his goal was to put this car on the road, put it on exhibit, and take the money and donate take the money from the admission tickets and donate it to charity. And as I recount in the book, he wound up donating an enormous amount of money to a variety of charities. And as such, he was able to deploy this car for good. The other side of the story, though, is that he used the car in ways that, you know, in today's lights may look a little bit less than tasteful. He had essentially the car on the carnival circuit, more or less. It was kind of presented that way. And yeah, he also used it as his family car, which, you know, one has to wonder how that was received in the pent-up, northern Chicago suburbs where he lived. But he was a showman at heart, and he thrived on publicity, and this car certainly gave him plenty of that.
And it seems that there were survivors of the Holocaust that had tattoos, serial numbers on their arms, who came and visited the car as a way of maybe encountering that great evil in a material sense. What did you make of that?
Yeah, that was one of the hardest things that I had to grapple with, was what exactly that meant. Christopher Janus died before I started this work, so I could not speak with him. Fortunately for me, he wrote and appears to have self-published a memoir, which is quite detailed. And I found in that memoir an account of him in his office and being visited by a young woman. I believe she was Hungarian, if my memory serves me. And she rolled up her sleeves and showed him her numeric tattoo and said that she had to see the car. And he asked her why, and she said it was a feeling that she couldn't explain. And I was content to leave that pretty much as it was, because I don't really think that there is a way to explain that. The closest that I could get is that facing Hitler's car, physically or psychologically, emotionally, however you want to, sketch that out, was in a way a form of facing Hitler. For Americans, it was the closest that they could get physically and contextually, you know, to the man himself. I think it would be too easy to say that, I hate the term closure, and I would never suggest that, mm-hmm. that looking at an automobile would ever begin to approach providing something like closure. I don't even really believe in closure. But I think that it's probably fair to say that, you know, people who are traumatized in whatever way often look for means of processing that. And it seems clear to me that for some people, this car was one of those ways.
The one car, the Mannheim car, it went through several different owners. And in fact, I believe that was the car that took the highest, it was up for auction. And,
yeah, in 1973, and, yeah. It was the most expensive used car in the world.
Yes.
Which is crazy, right?
Yeah.
It sold for $153,000, which at the time was 10 times the average household income of the United States. It's just an enormous amount of money. And in fact, it would go on to sell for even higher amounts after that. And so commercially speaking, the Mannheim car was certainly the more visible of the two. And it also demonstrated, for better or worse, that an automobile with a notorious past is one that has a great deal of commercial value for collectors, for promoters, for whoever has the personality and strength of gut necessary to own something like this.
And before we get to the trajectory of the other car, this car ended up in a private collection, and this is the car that you were able to see and visit.
I've seen both of them, but this one is in private hands of a collector in Southern California, and he's, I believe he was 92 or 93 at the time of my visit, which is, I guess, getting up on 2 years ago now. He himself was a World War II veteran and hero, I believe. It's not an exaggeration to say. Very distinguished gentleman and a very successful businessman who's quite a collector. In car collector circles, he's very well known. He was kind enough to open his home to me. He keeps the car in his private collection. The public cannot see it. He was kind enough to invite me, and I flew to California to see the car.
His desire for that car, and he restored the car as well.
He spent 20 years restoring this car, which is kind of mind-bending, but it's also a testimony to how enormous and complicated a machine it is, restoring a car that's 10,000 pounds and 20 feet long with hidden armor plating is not a picnic for any restorer. And it took the better part of 2 decades to complete this job.
And the other car, the car that Sergeant Azara discovered.
Yes, which our government sold off for a few thousand dollars.
Yes. And that has an interesting story. It hit into a museum in Canada.
The Canadian
Museum.
War Museum. It found its way to the Canadian War Museum, again, like just happenstance. It had been in the hands of two collectors in Canada. The second of the two apparently decided to divest the car, probably for a tax benefit of some kind, and offered to give it to the Canadian War Museum, which at that point had just around this time acquired a decent-sized museum building to use in Parliament Hill in Ottawa and was eager to acquire artifacts. And, of course, this was a big one. The problem that the museum had at the time and would have for many years is that the only thing around this particular car was hearsay and stories. It was believed to have been Hermann Göring's car. Nobody was really sure whose car it was. and could have been Hitler's, could have been Himmler's, could have been anybody's. It certainly, as an armored 770K Mercedes limousine, had been a car of the Nazi hierarchy. But museums obviously have very high standards of research and verification. And the Canadian War Museum was unable to substantiate who had owned or used this automobile, even as it had it on display. So it was a little bit of a sticky situation for them. The display caption on the car said literally that it was said to have been Hermann Göring's car, which was something that made the curators obviously uncomfortable because hearsay is not evidence. And so they struggled with that for many years until a librarian at the Canadian War Museum, his name was Ludwig Koch, stepped in and took it upon himself to unravel the mystery of this Mercedes-Benz, which is the end portion of my book and personally my favorite part of the story.
You've really developed a network of people, family of some of the original owners of the cars, and they all seemed very willing to share with you the stories as they recounted the, as they recalled them of the
car. Yeah, I was very lucky. I had looked for relatives of Christopher Janis. I was not able in the end to find anybody, but for the most part, all the other portions of the story, I was able to track down a friend or family member. In the case of Robert Pass of St. Louis, I was able to speak with a gentleman who had actually purchased the car at auction and owned it for about a year or so. And I was surprised because I thought, well, you know, here, I'm a stranger reaching out from nowhere, talking about an event that happened many decades in the past and say, you know, hi, my name is Robert Clara from Brooklyn, New York, and I'd like to talk to you about Adolf Hitler. It's just not the easiest opener in the world. And so I was getting ready for people just to stonewall me, but in fact, yeah, they were all willing to give me time. The case of one gentleman, Kirkland Gibson, he shared, his father had owned the car for a period of time. He shared an astonishing collection of photographs with me, and many of those are in the book. If it hadn't been for their willingness to come forward, I would not have this. I wouldn't have the color of the story that I have. I would have the bones of it, because you can always get that from the newspaper accounts. But I wouldn't be able to get the personal element that I like to put into these stories, because ultimately, even though this is a story about a thing, every good story is a story of people.
Yes, yes. Robert Clara, is there anything you'd like to leave us with? I so appreciated talking with you today.
Oh, no, thank you for having me. You know, if I've learned anything, well, I've learned many things from this, but one of them is that, especially in America, cars are a very unusual window into the human psyche. They reflect our ambitions, our insecurities, our social station, and as I unfolded this story in this book, it was a unique window not only to the people that owned this car, but in a very unsettling way, a window onto Hitler as well, because this car very much mirrored his personality. It was large, it was needlessly overpowered, it was frightening, and in many ways the car was kind of a metaphor for the man, and I don't want to make too much of that comparison. Prior to this book, I had never really looked at automobiles as a way of studying people, but now I do.
Well, thank you for this bit of research, and it's a lively read as well.
Thank you. I worked very hard to do that because this is not the easiest topic to make into what I hope is an enjoyable read.
My conversation with Robert Clara. His book is The Devil's Mercedes, The Bizarre and Disturbing Adventures of Hitler's Limousine in America. Earlier, we heard from Alexandra Chasen, and her book is Assassin of Youth, A Kaleidoscopic History of Harry J. Anslinger's War on Drugs. We've had production assistance from Anthony Garcia, Sean Knight, and Mark Prell. We stream online at krcb.org. You can subscribe to our podcast and listen anytime. I'm Suzanne Lang. Thanks for listening. It's a novel idea.